Okay. Do you hear me well? Yes. Okay. So, thanks. I want to join in congratulating the organizing committee for this great workshop and thanking for the opportunity to present our results in Laboratoire Mécoton. What I'm going to present has been taken by this wait a minute. By this team. So Kiluk is the PhD student. You probably all know Pierre Pillet, now emeritus in the lab. Stephen Lepoutre is a new assistant professor. He's actually 3 years now, but with COVID, maybe you didn't know he was in the team. And actually, Stephen Lepoutre and Kiluk have done a large part of the work that I'm going to present. Maybe I don't need to present Tom. It's his original idea when discussing with him, and of course, it's always great to have the opportunity to collaborate with Tom. The motivations for this work is basically from the fact that quantum simulation is already on, and we've seen many speeches, actually quantum computation as well. We had a great talk by Mark in the session already. What I'm emphasizing now is the fact that many groups are turning to divalent atoms for many reasons, but one that is of interest to us is highlighted, for instance, in this paper. It's maybe not the first, but one of the first presenting this idea of using the dipole transitions from the core electron to act on the Rydberg states directly. And this, the same laser here in green, could act both on the ground state and on the Rydberg state, or could act more on the Rydberg state, for instance. So you see many, many people working on divalent atoms now, and one trouble that could arise when you try to act on the core electron is something is known to happen, which is autoionization. If you actually ever get a doubly excited state, a single doubly excited state, it will crash. The energy will be exchanged between the two electrons, and one will be expelled. So you kill your Rydberg state in the process. Okay. So let me summarize again the idea of what could be done on such a system. So here I schemed in a more simpler picture what is going on. So from 6s2 ground state in ytterbium, for instance, with a few photon excitations, you reach a Rydberg state with a 6s core, and there you wonder what will happen if you send a laser light tuned basically close to the ion transition, so acting on the 6s electron to the 6p level. And with this red arrow here, I scheme the fact that due to the Coulomb interaction between the two electrons, there is a coupling to this continuum here back with the 6s core and expelling one of the electrons. And this happens in typically a few picoseconds. So, I mean, it seems useless to even try, but already it's an interesting way to make images, to detect your Rydberg atoms. You shine this light and they turn into ions, and you will scatter photons now on the ion. And this has been demonstrated some time ago already, and manages to give very beautiful pictures. But if you don't want to break the Rydberg state, then you have to find a trick. So one idea that we had was to go to high enough orbital momentum, and then you expect, because of the centrifugal barrier, that the Rydberg electron will not get close enough to the core to exchange energy with it, okay? And we did this study with the former PhD student, actually. And unfortunately, we found that ytterbium is probably the worst atom to do that. And you need to go to much higher orbital momentum compared to barium or strontium, for instance. So if you have strontium, maybe you could look into it, but it's not going to be easy anyway. So of course, you can always go all the way to circular states, and this has been beautifully demonstrated in LKB, Michel Brun team, and with very nice results showing scattering photons in the core without disturbing the Rydberg electron. So that's one way. But if you are interested in low orbital momentum states, what else can you do? Well, you can think of detuning your laser away from the ion transition, and perhaps that can be enough to avoid autoionization and to allow some kind of action on any orbital momentum. That's exactly what was proposed in this paper in the first place. Okay, so still, the autoionization will replace spontaneous emission as the leading decoherence process. So it means you will have to go probably further away from resonance than if you would compute a dipole trap on an alkali. Okay, so it means in the end, probably larger powers and maybe possible photoionization from some intermediate states. So you have to look carefully whether you will be sensitive to this effect or not. Another thing, now, if I may give a little more details in the level structure, another thing is that up there, I have a full Rydberg series, not just a single level. And you can think that, well, probably there will be a structure in the autoionization spectrum, not just a simple Lorentzian profile, okay? And well, actually, the answer was found some time ago, 1982. And yes, indeed, there is a structure. If here you start from 6s18s and you look at autoionization, so of course, if you aim at 6p18s again, you get the largest autoionization, but every time you aim at a different Rydberg level up there, you get an autoionization peak, okay? More interesting, in between some of the peaks, you have local minimas, and that's what I want to look for. So first, I want to summarize again what we've seen. First, when you try to use far-off resonance light, and many groups are already doing that on strontium, there is an unforeseen risk. You might end up on one of those autoionization resonances and get perhaps 10 times, 100 times more autoionization than what you had computed in the first place, assuming a Lorentzian profile. So eventually, you can always get far enough, but this is something to look for. And more interestingly, there is this new idea to use these local minimas, and I will now call them autoionization zeros, to allow much closer to resonance operation. Okay, so now the question is the autoionization reduced enough? Is the light shift that you get from this enough as well? So one slide of theory, but I will go quick on this. It was already shown in the 80s that the profile, the autoionization profile that you get is tractable from multi-channel quantum defect theory, and just two channel is already enough to explain the whole picture. So you get an analytical formula, which is very beautiful, and if you don't get into too much details, you just get two parameters. This capital R is the coupling strength to the continuum here with the red arrows, and the delta prime here, which is the quantum defect difference whether you have a 6s core or a 6p core. Okay, And that's it. You have the whole picture with these, with just these two parameters. So we also checked with optical Bloch equations, but I will not elaborate. So now you want to know, to get a way to know these two parameters, and this is what we did. So you excite Rydberg states with two photon excitation, so we get typically either singlet S or singlet D states. We chose singlet S, and once you have them, you shine ICE, isolated core excitation light here to excite levels up there and scan this laser frequency. And so the way to detect is selective field ionization that was already presented several times in this workshop. So you manage to know the number of ions that were created because of this light and the number of atoms that remained in a Rydberg state until you applied enough field to ionize them and detect. So you directly get the transfer ratio between the two. Okay, so you see that we get the spectrum here. We fit this spectrum with the MQDT formula, and you see that the MQDT formula captures very well the behavior of this autoionization spectrum. You can do that again for a different principal quantum number. This was for 60. You can look for 50, and you again can fit with the same formula. And the R and delta prime parameters are basically the same within 3, or, 10 to the minus 3. So you see it's a very stable model. Okay, now one thing I want to emphasize is that, for instance, if you look here at the first red zero for n equals 60, you see that it's not the zero for n equals 50. So in general, when you have a zero for one state, it is not a zero for another state. Okay, so that can be troublesome in some experiments, but that could also be of some help. So now we have these spectra, we can compute everything. We have the MQDT model, we can try to compute the shift. Okay, this slide is just, yeah, I cannot resist to show that when you look at the formula, if you scale correctly, you get a universal curve for any principal quantum number, and we check that all the data that I just showed earlier falls back on the same curve. Okay, so I was saying from the spectrum, you can compute the expected shift. You just need to realize the Cauchy principal part integral of your spectrum and compute the expected shift in the different situations. Okay, so now we wanted to observe this shift. So now what we do is that we shine the ICE light all the time and then perform the Rydberg spectroscopy of it and see if we can observe this shift. So for this, we have focused a little more the ICE light beam in order to imply large enough shifts, and then we can test this shift for different situations. The first situation is aiming at the detuning here, minus 12 gigahertz, that is not an autoionization zero. So then you have a correlation between the fact of being shifted and being ionized. So you see that in the data, the atoms coming out as Rydberg atoms are the ones that were not shifted and not ionized. So it serves as a reference line to observe the shift. It's very convenient. And you see that in the ion signal, the shift on up to about minus 10 megahertz that we observed here. Okay, so basically the expected shift when you compute from the principal part integral is about 10 megahertz. Then you can make a model taking into account all the excitation rate, autoionization rates, and so on, and extract the maximum shift at the center of the ICE beam, and we find about 12 megahertz, which is a very good agreement because the experimental uncertainty is on the order of 2 MHz anyway. Okay, you can do that on the blue side again, and of course then the shift is on the other side. Okay, now when you go to an autoionization zero, of course you will not have a reference line anymore. Your atoms should remain all in a Rydberg state. So what we will do is that we will shrink the Rydberg excitation beams so that we shift most of the atoms anyway, and look at the spectroscopic line, whether the ICE beam is applied or not. Okay, and this is the result. So first on the red zero, minus 18 gigahertz for n equals 72 is the first red zero. And you see that indeed the Rydberg's excitation line has been shifted. In this experiment, the expected shift was on the order of 3 MHz, and it's quite compatible with what we've seen. There's a residual ion excess when applying the ICE light here by about 2%. And here we think it's because we were not aiming right on the zero. So we performed this again on the blue side, on the first blue zero. And well, we see the shift. It's, well, experiment was a little less stable on this one, but at least we were aiming right on the autoionization zero, and we basically see no excess ion signal. So if you take as maximum amount that were created the amount of noise that you see, then it means it's less than 0.5%. So if from that you compute a minimum lifetime, you get about 1 millisecond, which is much larger than the Rydberg lifetime anyway. So you're not limited anymore by the autoionization when landing there. And I want to emphasize 3 MHz is about 300 micro-K, so it's already a good enough trap depth to be applicable in an experiment, while it's still 100 micrometer beam waste. So power issues should go down like a lot thanks to that. So now, what is the real limit? I'm happy to discuss that later. I think I should conclude fast. So I will just say one sentence on this. You again can get a universal law here, and we tested gathering all the data from the different principal quantum numbers that we could, that we did take, and it's gathered well to the same curve. I want to spend 1 or 2 minutes on the perspectives. Now we have demonstrated that it is working without autoionization to shift the atoms like this. You have many opened perspectives. So the first idea is that you could improve detection fidelity with joint detection. You could, for instance, shine some autoionizing light that is on the zero of the Rydberg state that you are exciting. So in principle, you will say, okay, it's doing nothing. But if you ever have a transfer due to black body radiation, for instance, it will immediately ionize and you can detect. So you know that you herald the failure of what you did. So you can at least post-select, you know that it was not working this time, and improve the overall fidelity of your gate or process, whatever. You could instead herald success if you have one Ancilla qubit, and in case of success, it gets to a state that ionizes, then you can detect it. Other ideas are about reaching magic conditions. So you could apply an additional tweezer on the ICE transition to get to act directly on the Rydberg state potential to adapt the trap potential to match the one in the ground state. And there is also local addressing possibilities to shift on or off resonance a very specific qubit. And along this line, I have to mention this result from Jeff Thompson in Princeton that was published back to back with our paper, and where he exactly did this, shifting on actually off resonance from Rabi oscillation of the Rydberg excitation. And you see here with the red, yellow, and green lines, depending on the exact detuning for your laser that you choose, if you don't choose the autoionization zero, well, of course, you have some losses. If you choose the autoionization zero, you blocked the Rabi oscillations with minimal losses. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Just the final data that you showed from Jeff Thompson's group is on the triplet, and mm-hmm. your stuff was all on the singlet side, right? So can you make a general comment on the differences between those two cases?
Yes, so you're right. Jeff Thompson's data is on the triplet state, ours is on the singlet state. I didn't mention, but I think any Rydberg level of a bosonic divalent atom, there will be a way to make it work. For fermionic, I don't know yet, but the fact that there is a nuclear spin means that in the ion there will be two different ionization limits, and they might badly interfere. So for fermionic atoms, I'm not sure. Maybe there is some specific levels that will work and some that won't. So that's something to investigate. I know that fermions are very interesting as well. But at least the general statement is that for any divalent bosonic species, any level will have these autoionization zeros. And of course, in this paper, they analyzed the curve here. The theory curve is not a two-channel model because they had Chris Green to perform yes. this calculation. I think he used a five-channel model. But a two-channel model is most of the time sufficient to catch most of the physics.
Okay, thank you. Rosario.
No.
many of these zeros in autoionization signals happen when you have something called Q reversal, right? This Fano parameter Q reversal, when you have channel interactions, which causes the yield to actually mm-hmm. drop to zero when it switches from positive to negative. So
I think it
happens in both cases.
I'm not sure I understand the question. You are making a link with Fano profiles, and it's not exactly the same, because Fano profile is interference with photoionization. Here it's interference between autoionization of different levels. But in the end, it's a quantum interference anyway.
Yes. I'm referring to autoionization. Yeah. So join me in thanking Patrick, Guido, and Mark for the